I brought out my portable kit and ran some tests. CA March, CA March, JA Ibisoin Aussie Dekulas. Say on Lieber Illustri. Dekulas Parfumies, Monsieur. Mais bien entendu, dehakis cher, d'opium, du sang, du rhum, encens d'église, de latrines, du pourriture. The package came to $10,000 plus $300 of regular art supplies. Alors, monsieur, vous avez le temps pour un cognac. J'ai toujours le temps pour ca. We start making books. I write the continuity. Jim does the drawings. We have the address of a modeling agency which puts us in touch with the film underground. We are in the right place. Lima is the film studio of the world for far-out porn and snuff films, mostly on contract to collectors and governmental agencies. Only the third-rate material finds its way into the open market. The best camera work, processing, special effects, and actors of all nationalities can be had here for a price. Jim sketches a scene in the rough. We stage it with live actors and then photograph it. Then Jim projects the color shots onto our paper for the finished product, which is something between photography and drawing and looks quite a lot like the Iguanas joke books. Monsieur Latour sells quality merchandise. The books seem to age 200 years overnight. I am working mostly on my pirate story line. But since I am sure of the quality of the goods, I will invest some more money in Mayan and Egyptian papers and colors, and do two snuff films, a Mayan number called The Child of Nintab, and an Egyptian number called The Curse of the Pharaohs. Nintab was the patron saint of those who hang themselves, whom she would transport straight to paradise. In this number a young aristocrat is hanged by Nintab, who then gives birth to a super potent death baby. The boy who plays the young aristocrat has a classic Mayan profile, and Nintab, spotted with decay, is a versatile pro who also plays in my Egyptian number as the evil sister of Tutankhamun. She has him strangled and gives birth to a scorpion goddess. $1 million is shrinking to expense account money at this point. I am already 100,000 clams into the $200,000. I figure it is about time to look up Bloom and Krupp before they come looking for me. It's a small town and word gets around. A cowboy in the 7 days a week fight. Tamagis is a walled city built of red adobe. The city stirs at sunset, for the days are unbearably hot at this season and the inhabitants nocturnal. As the sun sets, the northern sky lights up with a baleful red glow, bathing the city in light that shades from seashell pink to deep purple shadow pools. It is a summer night and the air is warm and electric with the smell of incense, ozone, and the musky sweet rotten red smell of the fever. Jerry, Audrey, Dalfar, John, Joe, and John Kelly are walking through a quarter of massage parlors, Turkish baths, sex rooms, hanging studios, cubicle restaurants, booths selling incense, aphrodisiacs, and aromatic herbs. Music drifts from nightclubs, sometimes a whiff of opium smoke. The painless ones who run many of the concessions smoke it. The boys pause at a booth and Audrey buys some red hots from a painless one. This aphrodisiac causes an erogenous rash in the crotch, anus, and on the nipples. It acts within seconds, taken orally, or it can be injected, but this is dangerous since the pleasure is often so intense that it stops the heart. Adolescents of the city play red-hot dare games known as hots and pops. The boys are dressed in red silk tunics open on their lean bodies, red silk pants, and magnetic sandals. At their belts they carry spark guns and long knives, sharp on both edges, that curl slightly at the end. Knife fights are frequent here since red hots can set off the raw red killing fever. The virus is like a vast octopus through bodies of the city, mutating in protean forms, the killing fever, the flying fever, the black hate fever. In all cases the total energies of the subject are focused on one activity or objective. There is a gambling fever and a money fever which sometimes infect the painless one, eyes glittering, they draw in the money with a terrible eagerness, trembling like hungry shrews. There is also an activity fever, the victims rushing about in a frenzy organizing anything, acting as agents for anything or anybody, prowling the streets desperately looking for contacts. Red Knight into Maggie's, dog catchers, spermers, sirens, and the special police from the Council of the Selected who are infiltrating to Maggie's from Yaswada. The dog catchers will seize any youths they encounter in the fair game areas and sell them off to hanging studios and sperm brokers. The spermers are pirates operating from strongholds outside the city walls, attacking caravans and supply trains, tunneling under the walls to prowl in the rubbly outskirts of the city. They are outlaws who may be killed by any citizen, like cattle rustlers. Two boys, faces blazing with alertness, slide from one red shadow pool to another. A patrol of dog catchers passes. The boys crouch in the darkness by a ruined wall, teeth bare, hands on their knives. The dog catchers are muscular youths with heavy thighs and the deep chests of runners. Naked to the waist, they carry a variety of nets and handcuffs around their shoulders, and bolos that can tangle legs at 20 yards. On leads are the hairless red sniff hounds, quivering, whimpering, sniffing, trying to fuck the dog catcher's legs. Audrey's lips part in a slow smile. This is one of his infiltration tactics. The dogs are trained to wrap themselves around a dog catcher's legs and trip him up. Audrey and Cupid Mount Etna are in a populous area with wide stone streets. A flower float of sirens passes. In conch shells of roses they trill, "I'm going to pop you naked darling and milk you while you're being hanged." Idiot males are rushing up, jumping on the hanging float to be hanged by the sirens, many of whom are transvestites from Yaswada. The floats wind on towards the hanging gardens where the golden youths gather with their hanging exempt badges. Like characters in a charade they pose and pirouette in the red glow that lights trees, pools, and diseased faces burning with the terrible lusts of the fever. Audrey decided on a detour. Four special police from the Council of the Selected stand in their way. They are crew-cut men in blue suits, looking like religious FBI men with muscular Christian smiles. "What can we do for you?" "Drop dead." Audrey snaps. He draws his spark gun and gives them a full blast. They fall twitching and smoking. Officially the SBS have no standing into Maggie's, but they are bribing the local police and kidnapping boys for the transplant operation rooms of Yaswada. The boys sprint around the bodies and turn into an alley, police whistles behind them. Possession of a spark gun is a capital offense. Dodging and twisting through the maze of narrow streets, tunnels, and gangways, they lose the patrol. They are on the outskirts now, near the walls, walking down a steep stone road. There is a road above them and a steep grassy slope leading up to it. Suddenly, a World War I ambulance truck stops on the high road and six men jump out, got up as pirates with beards and earrings. They rush down the slope, eyes flashing with greed. Spermers. Audrey drops on one knee, raking the slope with his spark gun. The spermers scream, rolling down the slope, clothes burning, setting the grass on fire. The truck is burning. Audrey and Cupid sprint on as the gas tank explodes behind them. The unconscious imitated by a cheesecake. The double gallows is the late place into Maggie's. At 11:30 it is still nearly empty. The bartender is checking bottles and polishing glasses. Some character is freaking out at the bar. "We're all a bunch of dirty rotten vampires," he screams. The bouncer throws him out. "We don't like that in here." "I mean it." A siren undulates in and trills for service. "You see that sign, lady?" The bartender points to a picture of a siren with a noose, "Will not be served here." The bouncer hustles her out. "It's an exclusive type place where everybody goes." "What do people do into Maggie's?" "They see the show. They all come here and see the big show. There's a hanging show every night. The bar is filling up now, because this is flasher night. The chic clients make their entrances through trapdoors in the floor and ceiling, or through disused side entrances, and even now they are popping up through the floor in green drag screaming like mandrakes, dropping down through the ceiling in gauzy parachutes or with ropes around their necks, slithering in through mirrors and screens. Some are completely naked, but most wear at least cowboy chaps, or scarves, or capes, or masks, or body paint, or sarongs, or snakeskin jock straps, or mercury sandals, or Scythian boots, or Etruscan helmets, or space suits with transparent ass and crotch. News peddlers circulate among the clients, stopping here and there as a table of young aristocrats feel the nooses, which are of various grades and materials, silk in all colors, hemp cured and softened in rare unguents, tingle nooses burning with a soft blue flame, leather nooses made from sniff hound hide. Audrey drops a noose languidly and waves to Jim across the room. Jim comes over and sits at his table. Audrey introduces him to Rubble Blood P.U., a slim elegant youth dressed in expensive 19th century clothes with a red rope mark around his neck, and to Captain Strobe, the gentleman spermer, in 18th century clothes, his yellow hair in a pigtail. Strobe too has the hemp marks around his neck. Cupid Mount Etna with a cupid bow mouth, yellow goat eyes, and curly hair, is naked except for goathood sandals. Blindish Wasp, black sideburns, eyebrows that completely cover the eye sockets, thin purple lips, is shaped like a wasp, thin rounded chest, a waist so narrow Jim could have put his hands around it, long thin legs. His skin is dead white and shiny, his cock pointed. He is naked except for a black skull cap and black pointed shoes of soft leather. He gives off a sharp aromatic odor. The guests are becoming impatient. Pop, 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 they scream. Lights go on in a little alcove and there is the double gallows. It's a hologram and it makes you queasy to look at it floating there in stagnant rotten air like a solid mirage you can almost drink out of and almost smell. The star is a dummy called Whitey because he cost as much as the white shark in Jaws. A door opens on the gallows and Whitey is led in by a red demon as the clients caper around the gallows, standing on tiptoe and twisting their heads to one side and making clicking sounds with their tongues. Now Whitey stands with the noose around his neck, pelvis tilted forward, cock almost hard, pupils pinpointed. The platform falls and he hangs there ejaculating and a blaze of light flashes out his eyes. A flasher. A flasher. The clients throw up their arms and wriggle their hips forward ecstatically, bathing in the flash, pushing each other aside, wallowing about in heaps. The gallows disappears. In an old silent film 1920s, guests are jumping into a swimming pool. Come along to our digs, old sport, says Rubble Blood P.U. This place is getting vulgar. P.U. leads the way through an area of vacant lots, rubble, and half-demolished buildings overgrown with weeds, scrub, and vines. Here we are. He stops in front of a three-story building. The two lower floors are torn down to the girders and concrete stairs lead to the third floor. P.U. unlocks a heavy door. The third floor is furnished in Moroccan style with rugs and cushions and low tables. Five of the crowd kids, all naked, are smoking hash. One gets up and does a belly dance while the others, at the four points of the compass, roll on their backs, legs in the air, clapping with their feet as they sing. They wear no clothes. And they dance up on their toes. And the dance they do is enough to kill a Jew. Rubble Blood P.U. and Captain Strobe are both very slender, with small aristocratic genitals, and they manage to look elegantly attired and perfectly poised when naked. A boy with long flaxen hair and flaring ears, naked except for a helmet, brings a tray of mint tea. P.U. shows Jim how to hold the glass by top and bottom so as not to burn his hand. Come along and I'll show you around the house. The crowd kids trail along, laughing and goosing each other. And here is the gallows room, all modern and convenient, as you can see. Our subjects wear hanging helmets, show him, Igor. Igor walks up grinning. The helmet extends around the neck and down to the collarbone, glares around the ears, and covers the shaven scalp. You see there are wires for brain waves to be recorded over here, throat mics in the helmet, and this. He holds up a little ring of transparent elastic. Always tailor-made, of course, and these magnetic tingle discs for the nipples. And the noose, scented with the subject's special smells, you know, his dirty underwear and jacked off in handkerchiefs. We've always been vampires, old sport. It's in the family. He takes a last look around. The best that money can buy, still it's a bit confining, old sport if you know what I mean. All in the mind, you know. The room behind him turns into Gatsby's book-lined study. Asterisk. One of your dizzy spells. Hans takes my arm. The boys have sated themselves for the moment. They are sitting around, shoulder to shoulder, passing cannabis cigarettes. Cuidado, hombre. A boy brushes a spark from his naked thigh, soft distant voices in the warm dusk. We are walking back through the stale air of Panama that eddies around our bodies and settles behind us. No fresh breezes stir here. The city is like a closed room, full of stale flowers and stagnant water. And no, old sport, there is someone I want you to meet, better nip in here first. He opens the door into a luxurious bathroom. See you in the drawing room. When Jim gets up to the drawing room, he sees a red-haired girl looking like Jerry's twin sister, dressed in red silk pajamas. The crowd kids sprawl in front of her, jacking off like she is a pinup. Audrey looks at his wristwatch. He is on patrol with Cupid Mount Etna. Time to hit the street. We are coordinated. The guard is manifold. Kelly, Clinch, Todd, Hans, and myself proceed now to the garrison to review the captured soldiers. Massive walls with four gun towers surround a courtyard along which living quarters are ranged. Hans and I, flanked by 10 partisans carrying razor-sharp machetes, step into the courtyard while Kelly, Todd, and John remain in the wardroom behind the bars. Tension. They understand that in any language. The soldiers shamble into a ragged line. Dirty, unshaven, frightened, they would seem to pose no threat. I walk slowly up and down, looking at each face in turn. A sorry lot for the most part, stupid and brutal, many of them showing the ravages of drink and disease. But two faces do stand out, a think hawk-faced youth with piercing gray eyes who meets my regard steadily, and a pimply boy with red hair who gives me an ingratiating smile. How many of you can read? The hawk-faced youth and two others raise their hands. A fourth raises his hand halfway. Well, can you read or can't you? Well, yes sir, but it takes me some time. You'll have plenty of that. I point to the articles. I want those of you who can read to read what is written there. I want you to read it carefully. Then I want you to explain what is written there to those who can't read. Is that clear? The hawk-faced youth nods with a slight smile. I'll be back later to see if what is written there has been read and understood. We then proceed to the house where the women are held, to be greeted by a chorus of shrewish complaints. No one will talk to them or tell them what had happened to their sons, husbands, and brothers. They have been denied medical attention and prevented from going to mass. I apologize smoothly for the temporary inconvenience and assure them that their husbands, son, and brothers are safe and being well cared for. I tell them that I am a qualified physician, and that if any of them are suffering from any pains or illnesses, I will be glad to receive them one by one in a room I have set up as my office. I have also brought a priest who will hear confession, grant absolutions, or perform any other priestly offices of which they are in need. The priest is none other than half-hanged Kelly, his hemp marks covered by a clerical collar. One by one, they troop into my office complaining of headaches, backaches, toothaches, chills and fever, shingles, flatulence, cramps, palpitations, catarrhs, varicose veins, fainting spells, neuralgia, and other ailments difficult to classify. To each I give a draft containing 4 grams of opium, with instructions to repeat the dose if their trouble returns, which of course it will at the end of 8 hours when the opium wears off. Needless to say, Kelly is also kept busy by the pious señoras. Returning to the garrison, I call the soldiers to attention. I walk down the line directing the 3 readers and the half-reader to stand forward. I then pick out 6 more, looking for faces and bodies that are reasonably well favored or show some signs of adaptability, intelligence, and good character. These 10 being brought to the wardroom, I ask if they have read the articles or had the articles explained to them. Article 1, No man may be imprisoned for debt. What does this article mean to you? A fresh-faced boy with an impudent smile and reddish hair speaks up. Suppose I run up a bill in the cantina and can't pay. I explain that debts to an innkeeper fall into a special category. If no one paid, there would be no cantinas and no wine. The hawk-faced boy asks, does this mean that you intend to release all peons even though they stand in debt to the patron? It means exactly that. We intend to abolish the peonage system. A mulatto boy looks at me suspiciously. Blank faces of the others show me they know nothing of the peonage system or how it operates. Article 2, No man may enslave another. What does this mean to you? Does this mean we get out of the army? The pimply boy asks. I explain that the Spanish army does not exist in areas we control. Our army consists entirely of volunteers. What do you pay? We pay in freedom and equal shares of any booty we take. The gold we have taken here in Panama will be shared equally among the soldiers who took part in the operation. I want to volunteer. He smiled and rubbed his crotch. Not intelligent exactly, but quick, intuitive, and brazen. A shameless one. What's your name?
Paco.
Yes, Paco, you can volunteer. You mean you're going to abolish slavery? The mulatto youth asks suspiciously. I mean exactly that. I'll believe it when I see it. No man may interfere in any way with the religious beliefs or practices of another. What does this mean to you? We don't have to go to mass. That's right. Nor may you prevent anyone else from doing so. That would apply to other religions. To Moors and Jews? The hawk-faced boy asked. Of course. Article 4, No man may be subjected to torture for any reason. How will you get information from prisoners? There are easier ways of doing that, as you will see. Article 5, No man may interfere with the sexual practices of another or force any sexual act on another against his or her will. What does this mean to you? You mean if I fuck another boy in the ass, no one can say anything. They can say what they like, but they cannot interfere. If they do, you would be justified in taking whatever measures were necessary to protect your freedom and your person, and anyone under the articles would be bound to assist you. The half-reader spoke up for the first time. Sergeant Gonzalez and Corporal Hasanovich kicked two soldiers to death for sodomy. Did they indeed? If the sergeant finds out, I told you that he'll have a knife in me.
A knife?
Yes, sir. He has a knife strapped to his leg. Interesting. Article 6, No man may be put to death except for violation of the articles. All officers of the Inquisition stand condemned under this article and subject to immediate execution. Do any of you know of any such officers present in Panama City? Father Domingo and Father Gomez are officers of the Inquisition, said the hawk-faced youth. Sent here to deal with pirates. They wanted to burn the English pirate as a heretic. Thank you. You will be rewarded for the information. The hawk-faced boy looked at me haughtily. I want no reward. Good. I turned to the half-reader. And don't worry about the sergeant. I am having him removed from the garrison. The others were similarly processed in groups of 10. Only 15 were suitable to be trained as partisans. 10 were obviously incorrigible rogues and troublemakers, chief among them being Sergeant Gonzalez, a snarling buck-toothed 200-pound hulk, and Corporal Hasanovich, a rat-faced gypsy. These 10 bastards were marched to the guardhouse adjacent to the garrison and locked in. In taking leave of them, I gave Sergeant Gonzalez a bottle of anise-flavored aguardiente containing enough opium to kill 5 men, enjoining him to share it equally with his companions. He leered at me, showing his yellow teeth. Cain, Señor Capitan. At the prison, I summoned the resident clergyman to a small interrogation room. I was seated behind a desk examining papers, armed partisans ranged behind me. Kelly, in accordance with his clerical costume, had left his gun in a corner. "Gentlemen, this is Father Kelly from Ireland." Kelly smiled and nodded unctuously. I studied a file in front of me, drumming my fingers on the desk. I looked up. "Father Gomez." "I am Father Gomez." A plump face, near-sighted yellowish eyes behind spectacles, a cruel absent-minded expression. "Father Domingo." "I am Father Domingo." A thin sour face, autos de fe smoldering in sulphurous gray eyes. "You are officers of the Inquisition?" I inquired midly. "We are clergymen." "Priests of God," said Domingo, glaring at me. He was not used to being on the receiving end. "You are dogs of the Inquisition. Sent here from Lima. You urged that our companion Captain Strobe be burned as a heretic instead of hanged as a pirate. You were overruled by Bishop Gardenas and Father Herrera. No doubt you are biding your time to revenge yourself on these honest men for their humanity." Without more ado, I drew my double-barreled pistol and shot them both in the stomach. Placing the smoking pistol on the desk, I snapped my fingers. "Father Kelly. Extreme unction." The other clergymen gasped and turned pale. However, they could not conceal their relief when I told them that as decent clergymen they had nothing to fear. I reloaded my pistol as Kelly delivered his bogus unction. "Well, I think you gentlemen could do with a drink." I poured for each a small glass of anise spirits containing 4 grains of opium. Sitting on a balcony overlooking the bay, sipping a rum punch as the sun went down, I reflected that the exercise of power conveys a weird sensation of ease and tranquility. I wonder how many of the 10 men in the guardhouse will be alive tomorrow. It amuses me to think of them cutting each other's throats over a bottle of poisoned spirits. The summary dispatching of the 2 inquisitors was based on a precept long used by the Inquisition itself, which is in fact the way they were able to maintain their power despite widespread opposition and hatred. Brutal sanctions against a minority from which one is generically exempt cannot but produce a measure of satisfaction in those who are spared such treatment. As decent clergymen, you have nothing to fear. Thus the burning of Jews, Moors, and Sodomites produces a certain sense of comfort in those who are not Jews, Moors, or Sodomites. "This won't happen to me." To turn this mechanism back on the inquisitors themselves gives me a feeling of taking over the office of fate. I am become the bad karma of the Inquisition. I am allowing myself also the satisfaction that derives from a measure of hypocrisy, rather like the slow digestion of a good meal. Troublemakers. Any body of men will be found to contain 10-15% of incorrigible troublemakers. In fact, most of the misery on this planet derives from this 10%. It is useless to try and re-educate them, since their only function is to harm and harass others. To maintain them in prisons is a waste of personnel and provisions. To addict them to opium takes too long, and in any case they are not amenable to useful work. There is but one sure remedy. In future operations, as soon as these individuals are discovered, either by advance intelligence or by on-the-spot observation, they will be killed on any pretext. In the words of the bard, "Only fools do those villains pity who are punished ere they have done their mischief." Today Hans is the city commandante, all spit and polish, bathed and shaved, green jacketed with silver skull and crossbones on his shoulders, khaki pants, his soft brown boots carefully shined. At the guardhouse, 5 of the prisoners are dead. It is easy to reconstruct what happened. Sergeant Gonzalez, attempting to keep all the liquor for himself, was attacked by Corporal Hasanovich and an accomplice. The sergeant killed them both with his knife and then drained about half the spirits, holding the rest at bay. The sergeant soon being overcome, the others took the knife and cut his throat. The victors then drank the remains of the bottle, which killed 3 of them. "Well, get them out of here." Hans gestures to the corpses. The partisans lead the way, planting shovels in the ground. We leave the prisoners digging graves like sullen Calibans and proceed to the barracks, where we are greeted by the smell of cannabis. The soldiers are laughing and talking, more relaxed now that 10 wrong men have been removed.
Ek Tung.
The way Hans can say it, anyone would believe it. The men are now brought to the wardroom one at a time. The hawk-faced youth, whose name is Rodriguez, acts as clerk, writing down answers as Hans fires the questions.
Name.
Age.
Place of birth.
Length of service. Locations and times of previous service. What training have you received as a soldier?
Training.
The man looks blank. What did you do all day?
Well, we had to drill and clean the barracks, cook and wash dishes, work in the captain's gardens.
What about your guns? You received instruction in their use.
There was daily target practice.
We fired them only at fiestas and parades.
Was there instruction in knife and sword fighting?
In unarmed combat?
No, nothing like that.
We could get a citation for fighting.
Field exercises.
KESSO.
That means you go into jungles or mountains to learn the terrain and pretend to fight a war.
We never left the city.
So you have no idea of conditions and terrain 10 miles outside Panama City?
No, sir.
During the time of your service here, have you been sick?
Various times, senor.
And what sicknesses have you had?
Well, sir, chills and fever, cramps and loose bowels.
Pox.
Yes, sir.
The whores are rotten with it.
And what treatment did you receive?
Not much.
The doctor gave me some pills for the pox that made me feel worse.
There was a sort of tea for the fever that helped a little.
You were formerly stationed at Cartagena.
What was the situation there as regards sickness?
Much worse, sir.
1,000 soldiers died of the yellow sickness.
That was when I was transferred.
Was the work there the same?
More or less, except we had to guard the mule train.
So you did leave the city at times?
Yes, sir.
Sometimes for a week.
And what was the mule train carrying?
You don't need to tell me.
Gold.
What else interests the Spanish?
Well now, all that gold to protect, the garrison must have been larger than here, perhaps 1,000.
10,000, sir, says the soldier proudly.
Hans pretends to be impressed and whistles softly.
And galleons no doubt to take away the gold?
When all those sailors came ashore there must have been some right brawls in Cartagena, Verdad.
Verdad, senor.
Big picture calling Shifty.
We return to staff headquarters, which we have set up in the governor's spacious bedroom on the ground floor.
This is the coolest room in the house, but even so the heat is oppressive and we must keep the windows covered with mosquito netting, which cuts off the occasional eddy of air that is the closest approximation to a breeze. There is a huge ornate curtained bed where exhausted partisans who arrive with dispatches can rest, where the staff officers can catch an hour's sleep or satisfy the sudden sex hungers that occur during the long hours of intense mental concentration without sleep. We often work naked in the governor's bedroom, seeing the maps with our whole bodies, performing ritual copulations in front of the maps, animating the maps with our sperm. The key map is big picture, showing the present area of occupation from Cartagena on the Atlantic seaboard to the Pearl Islands in the Pacific and northwards to a point 100 miles north of Panama City. Green pins on the map show cities occupied by the partisans. Black pins designate areas occupied by the Spanish. The key to big picture are ledger books. We are now transcribing into the ledger books information obtained from the prisoners.
Cartagena.
Location on map.
Black pin.
Estimated strength of garrison, 10,000 soldiers.
Strongly fortified.
Has resisted a number of pirate attacks.
Gold terminal.
Heavily armed convoys pick up gold here.
Hygienic conditions worse than Panama.
Recent epidemic of yellow fever.
These ledgers indicate not only the strength of garrisons and the movement of ships, but also the whole way of life of the enemy, what the soldiers do, what the officers do, what food they eat, what illnesses they suffer from, how they think, and what they can be expected to do. Rather like studying past performance to pick the winner of a horse race. But the Spanish, since they consist entirely of past performance, are much more predictable than horses. Massively encased in their colonial architecture, their forts and galleons, their uniforms, gold, portraits and religious processions, they move like ponderous armored knights to ends the was can predetermine. In addition to big picture, there are also much more detailed maps of smaller areas showing locations of arms caches, farmhouses belonging to partisans, streams, wells, and sketches of animals native to the region. As messages come in, the green pins are spreading north and east and south along the Pacific coast. The whole southern isthmus of Panama is now in our hands. We study the maps, concentrating on big picture. What exactly will the Spanish do? No doubt respond after their kind heavy, massive, and slow as their galleons. They will dispatch galleons from Cartagena to land troops on the east coast, who will then move west towards Panama City. They will dispatch galleons from Lima to the Bay of Panama to land troops above and below Panama City, in what they fondly think is a crushing pincer movement. On the eastern seaboard, we have every chance of a decisive sea victory. Here we have the Siren and the Great White, both now equipped with maneuverable cannons and exploding projectiles. No doubt all the British and French pirates and privateers in the West Indian area will gather like sharks at the smell of Cartagena gold. Our destroyers will be operating along the coasts and land partisans will make the landing of troops extremely costly. On the Pacific side, our sea forces are negligible, consisting of only a few destroyers in the Pearl Islands vicinity. We have, therefore, decided to evacuate Panama City at the approach of the Spanish galleons and let them land as many troops as they wish. In fact, the more they land, the better we like it. The Spanish, confident of victory, will then move north and south relying on heavy reinforcements from the east. Back in the barracks, the 15 who are to receive partisan training are lined up. I study each fact in turn. Rodriguez, the haw-faced boy with intense gray eyes, very intelligent, highly literate staff officer material. Juanito, a little Filipino, always smiling, eager to please, the mulatto reader Jose, a solid reliable face, steady nerves in combat. Kiki, the half-reader with a mongoloid face and straight black hair, nicknamed El Chino. Paco with his impudent ingratiating smile. Nemo, a slender yellow-skinned buck-toothed youth with a dancer's grace. Nimon, a curiously archaic youth part Negro with red hair, brown freckles, and a blank expression. He looks like one of the first mutant redheads from prehistoric times. Pedro, a handsome broad-faced boy with high cheekbones and a smooth reddish face. The others are less distinguished, country faces from farm families who have enlisted to escape grinding poverty. You have been selected for partisan training. Your instruction begins tomorrow. During 10 days of training, you will be paid 5 times your present pay. As soon as you join partisans in the field, the rate will be 10 times present pay and an equal share of any booty taken. You will be wearing cadet uniforms from now on. You can come and go as you like after training hours. Hans walks up and down measuring the boys with his eyes and writing measurements down on a clipboard. He hands the list to partisans, who return with a stack of uniforms and boots which they dump on a table. We direct the boys to strip and bathe. The boys are drawing water from the cistern and pouring it over each other with the usual horseplay and merriment. Paco sidles in behind Nemo and pretends to fuck him, rolling his eyes and showing his teeth and snorting like a horse. Cabron. Nemo screams, dodging away as he empties a bucket of water over Paco's head. I am the eternal spectator, separated by unbridgeable gaps of knowledge, feeling the sperm gathering in tight nuts, the quivering rectums, smelling the iron reek of sex, sweat, and rectal mucus, watching the writhing brown bodies in the setting sun, torn with an ache of disembodied lust and the searing pain of disintegration. Silver spots boil in front of my eyes. I am standing in the empty ruined courtyard hundreds of years from now, a sad ghostly visitant in a dead city, smell of nothing and nobody there. The boys are flickering shadows of memory, evoking bodies that have long since turned to dust. I am calling, calling with a throat, without a tongue, calling across the centuries, Paco. Joselito. Enriquette. Screenplay/Part 1. It is on the second floor. A brass plaque, Bloom and Krupp. A metal door. A bell. I ring. A cold-eyed young Jew opens the door a crack. Yes? You are client of salesman. Neither. I hand him my card. He closes the door and goes away. He comes back. Mr. Bloom and Mr. Krupp will see you now. He ushers me into an office decorated in the worst German taste with pictures of youths and maidens swimming with swans in northern lakes, the carpets up to my ankles. There, behind a huge desk, are Bloom and Krupp. A vaudeville team. Bloom is Austrian and Jewish, Krupp is Prussian and German. Krupp bows stiffly without getting up. Krupp von Nordenhals. Bloom bustles out from behind the desk. Sit down, Mr. Snide. I am the master here. Have a cigar. No, thanks. Well, we will have some fun at least. We will have an orgy. He goes back to his chair on the other side of the desk and sits there watching me through cigar smoke. And why have you not come here sooner, Mr. Snide? Asks Krupp in a cold, dry voice. Oh well, there's a lot of legal work in this business. I say vaguely. Jaundius and Werke. Yes, and us work. We want that you stop with the monkey business and do some real business, Mr. Snide. We are not a charitable institution. We do not finance ass fuckings. Now just a minute, Bloom and Krupp. I wasn't aware you were my clients. Krupp emits a short cold bray of laughter. Bloom takes the cigar out of his mouth and points the butt across the table at my chest. And who did you think was your million-dollar client? A green bitch synthesized from cabbage. Well, if you are my client, what am I expected to do exactly? Krupp whinnies like a cynical horse. You are to recover certain rare books now in the possession of a certain countess, Bloom says. I am not even sure I would know these books if I saw them. You have seen samples. I am not sure the samples correspond in any way to the alleged books I am retained to recover. You think you have been deceived? Not think. No. The room is so quiet you can hear the long gray cone of Bloom's cigar fall into an ashtray. Finally he speaks. And suppose we could tell you exactly where the books are. So they are in someone's private bank vault surrounded by guards and computerized alarm systems? I am supposed to sneak in there and carry out a carton of books slung over my shoulder in a rare tapestry, stamps and first editions in all my pockets, industrial diamonds up my ass in a finger stall, a sapphire big as a hen's egg in my mouth. Is that what I am expected to do? Bloom laughs loud and long while Krupp looks sourly at his nails. No, Mr. Snide. This is not what you are expected to do. There is a group of well-armed partisans operating in an adjacent area, who will occupy the Countess's stronghold. You will have only to go in after them and secure the books. There will be an outcry against the partisans who have so savagely butchered a rich foreign sow. Then stories will filter out about the Countess and her laboratories, and there'll be something in it for everybody. The CIA, the partisans, the Russians, the Chinese, we will have some fun at least. Might start a little Vietnam down here. Well, I say. You have to take a broad general view of things. We prefer a very specific view, Mr. Snide, says Krupp looking at a heavy gold pocket watch. Be here at this time Thursday and we will talk further. Meanwhile, I would strongly advise you to avoid further commitments. And bring your assistants and the books what you got, adds Bloom. When Jim and I go to see Bloom and Krupp on Thursday, we take along the books the iguanas have given me. Krupp looks the books over, snorting from time to time, and as he finishes leafing through each one, he slides it down the table to Bloom. Mr. Snide, Where are the books you are now making? Asks Grupp.
Books? Me?
I'm just a private eye, not a writer. You come to make with us the crookery, snaps Bloom, we break you in your neck.
Hans.
Willy.
Rudy.
Heinrich.
Herein.
Four characters come in with silenced P-38s, like in an old Gestapo movie. And now, your assistant will get the books while you and your lust nabe remain here. Hans and Heinrich will go with him to make sure he does not so lose himself. Hans and Heinrich step behind Jim. Keep 6 feet in front us at all times. They file out. In half an hour Jim is back with the books. B and K spread them out on the table and both of them stand up and look at them like generals studying a battle plan. Finally Krupp nods.
ACHJA.
With these I think it is enough. Bloom turns to me, almost jovial now, rubbing his hands.
Well, you and your assistant and the boy, you are ready to leave, Hein.
Leave?
Where to?
That you will see.
Hans, Rudy, Willy, and Heinrich march us up some stairs onto a roof and into a waiting helicopter. The pilot has a blank, cold, thuggish face and he is wearing a .45 in a shoulder holster. He looks American. The guards strap us into our seats and blindfold us and we take off. The flight lasts for about an hour. Then we are herded out and into another place, a prop job. Dakota, probably. About 3 hours this time, and we set down on water. They take off our blindfolds and we now have a different pilot. He looks English and has a beard. The pilot turns around and smiles.
Well, chaps, here we are. They untie us and we get out on a jetty. It is on a small lake, just big enough to set the plane down. Around the lake I see Quonset huts and in an open space something that looks like an oil rig. A barbed wire fence surrounds the area with gun towers. There are enough armed guards around for a small army. In front of a Quonset hut several men are talking. One comes forward to greet us, it is that CIA punk Pearson.
Well, Snide, he says.
Welcome aboard.
Well, Pearson, I say. If you can't lick them, join them.
That's right.
How about some chow?
That would be just fine. He leads the way into a Quonset that serves as a dining room. There are some long tables and tin plates and a number of men eating. Some of them look like construction workers, others like technicians. My attention is drawn to a table of about 30 youths. They are the best looking boys I have ever seen at one time, and all of them are ideal specimens of white Anglo-Saxon youth. Our genetic pool, Pearson explains. A fat mess sergeant slops some fish and rice and stewed apricots on our plates and fills tin cups with cold tea. Army style here, says Pearson. After we finish eating, he lights a cigarette and grins at me through the smoke.
Well, I guess you are wondering what this is all about.
Yeah. Come along to my digs and I'll explain. Some of it, at least. I know quite a bit already. Much more than I want him to think I know. And I know that the less he tells me the better chance I have of getting out of here alive. I've already seen that the oil rig is a rocket launching pad. Things are falling into place. He leads the way to a small prefab. He turns to Jim and Kiki, why don't you two look around? Do some fishing. You can get tackle at the PX. The lake is stocked with largemouth bass. You'll do well here. I nod to Jim and he walks away with Kiki. Pearson unlocks the door and we go in. A cot, a card table, some chairs, a few books. He motions me to a chair, sits down and looks at me. You saw the launching pad?
Yes.
And what do you think it will be used for?
To launch something, obviously.
Obviously. A space capsule that will also be a communications satellite. I am beginning to understand what they are planning to communicate. Now, just suppose an atom bomb should fall on New York City. Who would get the blame for that?
The commies.
Right. And suppose a mysterious plague broke out attacking the white race, while the yellow, black, and brown seemed to be mysteriously immune? Who would be blamed for that?
Yellow, black, brown.
Yellow especially.
Right.
So we would then be justified in using any biologic and slash or chemical weapon in retaliations, would we not?
You would do it justified or not.
But the plague might well decimate the white race, destroy them as a genetic entity. We would have the fever sperm stocks. We could rebuild the white race to our specifications, after we.
The table of 30 boys flashed in front of my eyes.
Pretty neat.
And you want me to write the scenario?
That's it?
You've written enough already to get the ball rolling.
What about the Countess de Gulpa?
How does she figure in this?
Ah, the Countess.
She doesn't figure.
She is not nearly as important as you may have thought.
She would hardly go along with destroying the blacks and browns, because she makes her money out of them.
She still thinks in terms of money.
Her laboratories.
Not much we could use.
Certain lines of specialized experimentation.
Interesting, perhaps.
She has, for example, succeeded in reanimating headless men.
These she gives to her friends as love slaves.
They are fed through the rectum.
I don't see any practical applications.
We had thought of using her in scandals to discredit the rank and file CIA, but that won't be necessary now.
I dare say you could wipe her out with rockets from here.
Easily.
Or we could use biologic weapons.
The black fever?
Yes.
He pointed to the radio.
In fact, I could give the order right now.
So what do you want from me?
You will finish the scenario.
Your assistant will do the illustrations.
And then?
You have been promised $1 million to find the books.
You have found them.
Of course, money will mean nothing once this thing breaks, but we will see to it that you live comfortably.
After all, we have no motive to eliminate you, we may need your services in the future.
We're not bad guys, really.
How nice will these guys be once they get what they want from me?
If I am allowed to live at all, it will certainly be as a prisoner.
I am trying to stall Bloom with a slick number called Naked Newgate about a handsome young highwayman and the sheriff's daughter.
Bloom isn't buying it.
Any $1,000 a week Hollywood hack could write such a piece of shit.
Then Pearson asks me over for a drink and a little chat.
It sound ominous.
By the way. Bloom isn't exactly happy about the screenplay.
Niz baby, E.T. up all the screenplay.
He looks at me sharply.
What's that, snide?
It's a joke.
Fitzgerald in Hollywood.
Oh, he says, a bit intimidated by the reference to Fitzgerald, perhaps something he should know about.
He clears his throat.
Bloom says he wants something he calls art.
He knows it when he sees it and he isn't seeing it now.
What I like is culture.
What I like is art.
I screech in the tones of a crazed Jewish matron.
He gives me a long blank sour look.
More jokes, snide.
I'll give him what he wants.
I'm staging a little theater production tomorrow, very artistic.
This had better be good, snide.
A slim blonde youth in elegant 19th century clothes stands on a scaffold.
A black hood, laced with gold threads, is drawn over his head.
Rubble blood pu.
End of part I.
Stuck in dead smallpox nights of last century.
This satined ass in yellow light.
Yellow fleck storm waves, palm trees, wide strip of sand, a corduroy road.
I don't remember hitting.
I really don't think so, the truck shadow, trees tasting cement, green dark water.
Good English soldier of fortune, sir.
Work for you, yes no.
Spelling years whisper the lake heavy red sweater, trash cans in yellow light.
The sigh of harmonica flags in the sad golden wash of the sunset singing fish luminous sky fresh smell of damp violets.
Man smell of dirty clothes red faces breath thick on tarnished mirrors.
Sunset, train whistles.
I am on the train with wearing. Red clay roads and flint chips glitter in the setting sun. Pilots the plane across time into a waiting taxi, steep stone street, boy with erection yellow pimples turn of the century lips parted, red hair freckles a ladder. A young face floats in front of his eyes. The lips, twisted in a smile of ambiguous sexual invitation, move in silent words that stir an ache in his throat with a taste of blood and metallic sweetness. He feels the dizzy death weakness breathing through his teeth, his breath ice cold. The boy in front of him lights up inside, a blaze of light out at his eyes in a flash as Audrey feels the floor drop out from under him. He is falling, the face floating down with him, then a blinding flash blots out the room and the waiting faces. Cheers, here are the non-dead. A tenor voice was singing in my head. A touch of sun, a touch of sun. The color sergeant said. I woke up with something cold on my chest. A doctor was sitting by my bed with a stethoscope. Hello there, young guy, he said when I opened my eyes. A naval officer stood beside the doctor, looking down at me. I could feel a cast around my neck. The doctor turned to the other officer. Heart sound as a gold dollar. Should be out of the cast in a week. The officer looked down at me from some stinker of a battleship film, if you feel like that again, son, so see the shrink or the chaplain. Would someone show me my face in the mirror? The doctor held a hand mirror in front of me. A shock of recognition. Familiar young face. Red hair. Just wanted to be sure I was still there. The doctor and the officer laughed, and I heard the door close. The face looked at me from the foot of the bed. Hello. I'm Jimmy Lee. You're Jerry. We're identical twins. I'm in the medics, you're in communications. U.S. Navy, 6 years service. Depressed over the death of your pet monkey, you tried to hang yourself. I cut you down in time. That's our story. You want to remember. They had to be careful about sex in the Navy, so Jimmy and Jerry got a book on astral projection and decided to learn to do it in the second state, as the book called it, and they finally succeeded, though they never knew exactly when it would happen or who was going to visit whom until it happened, and this was sometimes under embarrassing circumstances, like in the shower room or during a physical examination. One twin lets out an eerie high-pitched wolf howl and turns bright red all over as the hairs on his head and body stand up and crackle. Then, as if struck by lightning, he falls to the floor in an erotic seizure, ejaculating repeatedly in front of the appalled and salacious TARS. A slack-jawed pimply boy from East Texas watches with a bestial leer. Look at his Peter. Medics. Jimmy describes a typical attack to a flustered Navy psychiatrist. First there's this smell, doctor. Like skunks in heat, if you'll pardon the expression, sir. It chokes you and gets you hot. Like a popper, sir. He makes a motion of breaking a popper under his nose, moans and shows his teeth. The doctor coughs, opens a window and pulls up a Venetian blind. Sunlight streams into the room. And then Jerry's face comes into focus like. He titters. That reminds me of a joke, sir. This old Jew, sir, got his wife and Mrs. Lieberman from next door in his car, he is driving out into the country to focus his headlights, sir, and he's got a sheet to do it with, and Mrs. Lieberman sees him getting the sheet out, sir, and she says. What's he gonna do? He's going to focus. What? Both of us. Rather good. Don't you think, sir? Looking at me with this smile, sir. He leers at the doctor and squirms in his chair. And his body, sir, is a translucent red haze. I got that word out of a Navy bulletin on poison fish. Some of them is translucents. You can see all their guts, sir. He looked pointedly at the doctor's stomach. It's like Jerry vaporize hisself. He just steams right into me, feeling and wriggling down into each glittering leg hair, sir. Jimmy hitches up his pants to show white ankles with red hairs that stir and glitter in the sunlight. With little electric prickles, sir, into you know and you know and you knows.
Then I am going down very fast in an elevator, you knows the feeling, sir, right here. He cups his crotch. And Jerry is floating down with me. Then silver light pops in my eyes, sir. He makes a loud popping sound with his mouth. The doctor starts. And I shoot off and everything turns red. We call it a red out.